Crying is one of the most basic emotional responses in humans. In fact, we are the only living creatures who cry for emotional reasons.
But why do we cry? And why do we get pleasure from crying in some instances? These are among the questions our next guest explored in his book, Why Humans Like to Cry: Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain.
Michael Trimble is an emeritus professor of behavioral neurology at the Institute for Neurology in London. And Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very, very pleased to be in touch with you.
I want to start out with sort of the premise of the book, because I have to say, I thought it was going to be easier than it was. But all of a sudden, I'm reading about Nietzsche, and I'm reading about neurophysiology, and I'm reading about evolution. And crying, which seems so simple on its face, really is not simple at all.
Well, yes, I think there's a difficulty in the way that maybe I have to approach the book as a neuroscientist. And one of the things that intrigues me is to think about brain processing in humans, Homo sapiens, that's our species, in relationship to our hominid ancestors and indeed our earlier ape ancestors. So if it is true that only humans cry emotionally, and our species has been on the planet for, nobody quite knows, but anything between 250,000 years and perhaps a million years, the question is, to what extent are our brains different that allow us this facility not only to cry emotionally, but also to be able to get some pleasure or meaning from crying? So the book is very much orientated towards some neuroanatomy. I often tell my friends who I give copies of the book to say, well, you know, read the first two chapters and the last two, and I'll forgive you if you miss out the middle bit.
Well, it is complicated, but there is an awful lot there. And I have to ask you, why, as someone who could, you know, there are any number of topics you could have chosen to write about, what is it about crying that really intrigued you and made you want to sit down and do the research and do the book?
Thank you very much. The point is that for many years I've been involved in research into those areas of the brain, particularly the human brain, that relate to our emotions. So much neuroscience and neurology has been concerned with cognition. That is, you know, thinking and logic and how we can do things with movements, praxis. But there's also an undercurrent that has looked at the way our emotions influence our cognitions, our emotions influencing the way we think. And certainly, when you begin to look at emotions and our emotional responses, there are certain things that lead people to crying for emotional reasons. Now, I don't want to suggest that emotions are the only reasons that we cry. So, you know, if somebody puts salt in your eye or you get an infection, then you can get tears. But what's interested me is why we cry emotionally, for emotional reasons, and other animals on the planet do not do so. And I cry to a number of things, but one of the things that really leads me to cry, and also 90% of the people that we survey, is music. So I started going from the neuroanatomy, looking for differences in the human brain in relationship to, say, a chimpanzee brain, but then asking, what things lead us specifically to crying? Now, bereavement, of course, and sadness and loss are universal, and that is a universal experience. But when we started looking at the arts, the interesting thing was that if you ask people if they cry to music, to poetry, to paintings, to architecture, to sculpture, 80 or 90% of people will say, yes, music releases tears. It's about 60% with poetry, but when you become, when you get down to asking about crying to looking at a painting or a sculpture, you're really down to the 5% level. So there's something special about music, and I was interested in that because music is certainly one of the things that leads me to cry. So that was really the basis of trying to explore the links between crying and art, and in particular art and tragedy, the art of tragedy. Why do we go to the theater to see tragedy and cry and feel better afterwards?
And going back to the music, what did you find in terms of the type of music that elicits these strong emotions within us?
Well, that's a very interesting question, too. I'm personally rather interested in sort of romantic classical music as the provocateur of crying. But, you know, any piece of music that has autobiographical relevance, in other words, the relevance for our lives personally, can lead to crying. So, you know, what was the, you hear a tune on the radio and it was the tune when you first fell in love, you know, 10, 20, 30, however many years ago it was, that can be very provocative. On the other hand, there may be tunes or music which is rather special to a family, that, you know, that's our tune, so to speak. But on the other hand, there are composers who just know how to lead people to cry, and whether you choose, you know, Puccini or Verdi or Wagner, somehow they knew how to make people cry with the music structure that they embedded into their pieces.
And one thing that I'm sorry to step on you there, but one thing that you hone in on as well is the opera specifically. And I think opera has a unique way of drawing someone into a story where, even if it's not autobiographical to us, we develop a certain amount of empathy, perhaps, for the protagonist. And those often end in tragedy, too. But opera, you highlight, is a unique form of music.
Well, that's extremely relevant because, you know, opera is a drama. I mean, if you have an opera and there's no drama, you won't get much from it. So there's a drama on the stage, but the drama is compounded with music, and it's also often compounded with the poetry as well. So many operatic pieces have embedded within the original language a poetry that goes with the music. And it's considered that opera, as we see it today, is today's representative of what used to go on the Greek stage, the Greek tragic stage, 2,500 years ago. And so there, you had a drama, you had religion, which is quite interesting. There were often religious festivals. They usually involved a protagonist who was a hero who suffered as a hero. But in terms of the performance, as today, on the stage, what people saw was a drama with poetry and music put into that. And so there's something very deep about the heritage of our artistic appreciation, which the Greeks at least captivated and has been captivating us ever since. And when you think about it...
Well, Michael, we will get back to that after the news. We're talking with Michael Trimble. He's author of Why Humans Like to Cry, Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain.
And we hope you'll get in touch with us, too. Have you noticed that certain situations, life experiences, or even songs are sure to make you cry? Do you find crying cathartic, or do you do everything you can to avoid it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Right now, we're talking with Michael Trimble, an emeritus professor of behavioral neurology at the Institute of Neurology and the author of the book we're talking about, Why Humans Like to Cry, Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain.
And we want to hear from you, too. What do you want to know about this uniquely human emotional response? What works of art move you? Do you derive pleasure from crying? Is it cathartic for you? You can let us know at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you could tweet us at CentralTimeWPR.
We're going to be getting to our calls in just a moment, but before we do that, before the break, we were talking a lot about some of the things that make people cry. But Michael Trimble, we'd also like to talk about what's happening inside of our brains when we're getting that information, whether it's bad news or a piece of music or just something that, and I understand it's complicated. So what is the short version of what our brains are up to when we're making that sort of that decision, I guess, to cry?
Yeah, the short answer is that the feelings begin in the stomach. They're visceral, that's the word for it, and you get gut feelings. And the gut feelings are generated by parts of the nervous system which are referred to as the autonomic nervous system. They're unconscious initially, and they the part of the nervous system that keeps us going, alters our emotional responses to our environment moment by moment. But the interesting thing and important thing about the human brain relates in particular to our memories and our autobiographical memories. It's arguable to what extent a chimpanzee, for example, has long-standing autobiographical memories, memories of personal experiences that go back to childhood. But from the human point of view, we know that many of our emotional responses are set up during our childhood period of time. And you know, I talked about music, and one of the most interesting things about music is our exposure to it when we're very, very young indeed. So what happens when a baby cries tears, that is, not just cries out, but cries tears, is that the mother will come to mollify the child. And what mother does is sing to the child. The whole voice of the female, the voice with which she will sing lullabies, are comforting to the child, to us. They mollify, they reduce the tension. And they obviously become embedded in a very, very personal relationship, bonding with the mother. Now, the mother does something else. She holds the baby. She rocks the baby. And so you also have movement and music early embedded into our conscious experiences of meeting the world in terms of loving relationships. So part of the reason that we cry, I think, to music, certainly relates very much to that, to our very, very early experiences of music in lullabies and the way that that mothers sing to us. It's universal that mothers sing to babies. They sing in a frequency, a sound frequency, which is not the normal adult frequency, but it's a higher pitch frequency. Just happens to be the frequency which sopranos tend to sing during the opera. So, you know, there are links there between early linguistic musical experiences and responses to crying which are satisfactory, hence the possibility of, in adults, a kind of cathartic experience you referred to. The way that when you cry, there is a relief of whatever emotion it was that was building up.
And Michael, let's take a call from Chris in Sparta. He's waiting to talk to us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have a tendency not to cry, and I'm just curious. I mean, I've never had any true tears come out of my eyes from any music whatsoever or any, even, you know, tragic situation. I might get a lump in my throat, but that's pretty much as far as it gets with me, and I'm wondering, am I just a poor test subject, or are there others like me out there?
Thanks, Chris.
Right. That's very interesting. In one of the radio interviews I did back here in England, I did an email questionnaire, which we sent out electronically, asking for information only from people who never cried. So the norm is that people cry. The norm is that more females cry and cry more frequently than males. But the number of people who never cry is actually, well, larger or greater than one suspects. These problems have never been studied. A number of people are very concerned that they don't cry. And one of the problems is holding in emotional responses when others would prefer to release them. Now, there's, of course, a story embedded in literature, or if you like, in plays like Shakespeare's King Lear, whereby the suppression of tears leads on to, well, in Lear's case, certainly a form of madness, and the suppression of emotion can be very difficult for people. There's no studies about treatments. There's no studies about the adverse effects, but a lot of people have expressed the same, that they would really like to cry, but somehow hold it back. Now, if I could just say one more thing, tends to be more with men than women. And if you go back a while, for men to cry, it was considered just not male, just not masculine. Nowadays, the media in America, for example, are happy to show President Obama crying or other famous sportsmen crying. They're happy to show film stars crying, males, that is. So the images of males crying on the media has become much more prevalent recently, and I think that's allowed men to feel that they don't have to suppress the tears when they get the feeling in the throat.
There's certainly a lot of social influence that might weigh into one's response to cry. Even if one is feeling like they want to cry, they might be too embarrassed to actually go ahead and do that, especially if it's in a public forum. But one thing that you also write about is that the muscles around our eyes can actually influence the way we feel. Why don't you talk about that just briefly?
Well, that's quite interesting because, you know, I'm sure I'm not speaking to anybody directly, but there have been some investigations on people who've had Botox injections to alter the wrinkles around the eyes. And so when you do Botox injections, if you give too much and you alter the muscular activity around the eyes, so the eyes don't respond as they do when we cry, you actually, if you do then brain imaging, you show that the responses of those people, from a brain imaging point of view, those bits of the brain that are activated when we are about to be emotional, actually don't activate particularly well. And so there is some feedback from the muscles of the face, but particularly around the eyes, to the central nervous system, which again is part of the reflex of bringing on the tears. And I think that actors use this. You know, if they have a reflex when they alter the muscular tension around the eyes, that this can lead to a reflex which then produces the tears. But these were investigations done with Botox.
That's tech. We've got time for one more call, so let's go to Jim, who joins us from Osceola. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The poet Jane Kenyon observed how like the sound of laughing weeping is. And the other observation I had was there's parts of the Messiah that bring me to tears that has nothing to do with the libretto or nothing autobiographical for myself. It just seems to be maybe the juxtaposition of chords or whatever. It's just the beauty of the music itself that brings me to tears.
Jim, thanks so much for the call and a couple of things in there. First of all, you know, that sort of that idea that a piece of music can make you cry and you're not quite sure why, you just know that it does. But his first comment, the poem about that difference between laughing, another emotion, and crying, that's very interesting.
I think it is very interesting. We talked about people who don't cry and how little research has been done in that. The other aspect to crying is, of course, tears of joy. And tears of sadness and tears of joy do merge to some extent, but it is quite true that we do have tears of joy. And I can just briefly tell you that recently the National Lottery here in England, I know you have lotteries in America, got in touch with me, would we study what happens, because they were fascinated that when people were given a check for $1 million, they would burst out crying, and they thought this was somewhat paradoxical. So we have been doing studies on tears of joy, and they are different from the tears of sadness or even maybe the tears brought on by music, because they're quite short-lived. You know, people get over it very quickly, whereas the tears that relate to bereavements or indeed the tears that relate to musical experiences very often linger for quite some time.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me, and great pleasure.
That was Michael Trimble, Emeritus Professor of Behavioral Neurology at the Institute for Neurology in London. He's the author of Why Humans Like to Cry: Tragedy, Evolution, and the Brain.